Good morning. Welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Jewett and your co-host today is Michael Cigani. Good morning to you, Michael.
Morning, Hugh.
We're talking about competition today as the Competition Commission gets ready to put a new law into full practice. The idea of the ordinance is to give us more choice at competitive prices, but the actual interpretation and implementation of the law is debatable, and the Commission has launched a consultation to do just that, to debate it. So how tough should it be? When should it go to court, for example? What should be the priorities, and what about the remedies? Give us a call with your thoughts. Our number is 233-88266. You can text 63935925. You can email backchat@rthk.hk. That's backchat@rthk.hk. Or you can go to our Facebook page, Backchat and RTHK Radio 3, and comment there. After 9.20 this morning, we're talking about the ferry fare hike. Joining us in our central studio is David Webb, founder and editor of website.com, shareholder activist, and joining us on the line, Sandra Marco Colino, who's assistant professor in the Faculty of Law at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and also joined in our central studio now by Ronnie Tong, who's a legislator with the Civic Party, who's had a long-standing interest in the competition law. Ronnie Tong, maybe we'll start with you. You're last to arrive.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us now. We're getting pretty close to seeing this actually kind of coming about,
finally,
aren't we? Because the law was passed in 2012.
That's right.
Is it? And so it's pretty close now.
It's been a long time coming, and I'm very glad that the commission came to LegCo to report the progress so far. In particular, I'm very pleased to hear that the judiciary has appointed Mr. Justice Godfrey Lam to be the judge in charge of the tribunal. Now, many of you may not know Godfrey. He's one of the brightest young men coming up the ranks that I've seen in many years. And he recently became a High Court judge. And from what I've heard and what I've seen, he has been, you know, a really bright light in recent batch of newly appointed judges. So I have every confidence that he would be, you know, a very good choice to head the tribunal, and I hope the tribunal would make some good examples out of enforcing the competition law.
Well, that's a great ad for Godfrey Lam, did you say?
Now, he's a very, very bright man.
Okay, yeah, now...
Very, you know, bright. I mean, he's young, but he's very bright.
Anna Wu is a very bright woman, isn't she?
I won't say she's very young.
Okay. I didn't say
no,
that.
She's by comparison to Godfrey.
She's a good person to have.
By comparison to Godfrey. Yeah. But Lana, we have been in constant touch, she has a determination to make this work, and again, I'm very pleased.
How is it going to work? I mean, the thing is, it's there, like you say, it's been a long time coming, it's finally there. Are we going to see the end to, pricing, manipulating pricing in supermarkets and stuff like that?
Well, like democracy, I mean, you can't regard it as a penicillin for everything. You can't see, you know, a sea change immediately after the law coming into force. And you also need to understand that in the commission, the chief executive has appointed, in fact, the majority of members in the commission are very closely related to the business sector. Some of them are, in fact, strong opponents of the law. And so when, you know, CY Leung announced the various appointments to the commission, I was very worried that this would stifle the effectiveness of the law, but I now see that Anna Wu is working very hard. Is very determined to make this work, and I think the new CEO would be a good choice. So I'm still fairly optimistic that something good would come out of it.
Do you think they should be tough? Do you think they should be tough?
Oh, definitely. But it would be a hard decision to make in choosing the first one or two cases. If you look at the history of other jurisdictions, you will see that the first few cases will make or break the commission. They have to choose correctly, go after somebody who the community sees as an example of being anti-competitive.
Well, I can think of a few names right away. I won't mention them. I mean, I can think of many, many companies that are anti-competitive in Hong Kong.
Well, you don't have to worry about it. You're fully protected by the law, I think. but in any way, what I'm saying is that, one, they have to pick their targets wisely. Two, they have to ensure that they should win in the first few cases. And, you know, if they lose, and if they lose badly in the first few cases, people would start to lose confidence in the commission, and then it won't work. Because I think you need to build up a confidence in the community so that people would go to you to blow their whistle. You know, they have to rely on whistleblowers
Do they rely on whistleblowers?
Very heavily.
But can the commission itself instigate something itself rather than wait for somebody to say...
Yeah, but you still need somebody to come to give you inside information. Like very much like the ICAC, this is how competition commissions all over the world operate. They rely very heavily on people coming forward to, give information to them, and not simply to complain, but to give information to them to enable them to, start the investigations. This is very important.
Sandra and Marco Colina, good morning to you, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Hi, thanks for joining us. What about the case of companies that just don't understand the ordinance? It's new. The whole principle is new, basically, to Hong Kong. Do you think that there should be some leeway given bearing that in mind?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure to discuss these very important issues. I would start by saying that I think that by reading this new report that finally we've heard from the Commission, we can see that there is an insistence on assisting the local businesses and consumers to ensure that they really know the benefits that can be derived from the application of the law for them, and also that they, of course, comply with the law. So I think a huge part of the work of the Commission for the next year and a half is going to be focused on that, and that I think is really, really important for success of the implementation of the law.
So are you hopeful now this thing, like Ronnie Tong's been saying, it's been a long time coming. You say you're happy that it's all out there now. Do you think that they'll be picking like a big company as an example and say, we really mean business?
Well, that is hard to say, of course, at this stage. I think that, first of all, the next big step will be guidelines, the issuance of guidelines. That's when we will know a little bit better what the policy will be. At the moment, there are signs towards that maybe a big company will be pursued.
Because it's really got to have its credentials now, as Ronnie Tong says, right? It means business.
Of course. I mean, it seems, what we have now, the report that we have now, and this discussion paper is still very vague. But what we can see already is an intention to, of course, pursue big cases. We've got some the establishment of some priorities in the enforcement. So we see that they will target those conducts that are really harmful for consumers and the economy. And also there is reference to pursuing concentrated markets, so problems in concentrated markets. So that is perhaps a hint towards those markets which are, the most problematic markets, which are concentrated, where consumers and the economy as a whole does not really benefit from the benefits of competition.
Okay, David Webb, davidwebb.com. Do you support this? I know you're very much a free market person.
Yes, I support the competition law. I support having a better one than we got, but it's a start. The muddled thinking that went into it and the compromises that were made resulted in, for example, no merger controls, various kinds of exemptions for statutory bodies rather than and automatically opting them all out and then opting some of them back in rather than the other way around.
Sorry, there's a merger rule.
They're only for telecoms companies.
That's been in the law for a long time.
That's how we've benefited from a very competitive telephone market after HKT's monopoly was abandoned in the 1990s. If you look at the logo on the cover of this document, that's the first thing that struck me about confused thinking. You've got a chessboard with three colours of squares on it, white, grey and pink. You've got two opposing pieces, both of which are white, which suggests an element of collusion. And then you've got and both of them are pawns, which suggests that they're only going after the little guys rather than the tycoons behind them.
Very insightful.
So, you know, a certain amount of lack of care, I think, has gone into that design of logo, and that's really emblematic of the whole legislation. So, you know, we'll work with it, but it would be nice to have something better. And you know,
how better, Mr. Webb? How? I mean,
well, for a kickoff, proper merger control has been proven to work in telecom sector. It's worked in many other economies, and it should have applied to the whole market. Secondly, with the statutory bodies, they should have looked at their functions rather than the whole sort of whole company basis. For example, you should look at the Trade Development Council and say, okay, if we think that there's a statutory role for promoting trade in Hong Kong, that's fine, but you can't cross-subsidize your exhibition organizing because there are private sector people who would like to organize exhibitions. And with the post office, we should say, okay, you have a universal service obligation to deliver mail, and there's a postal monopoly, but you shouldn't be able to use the profits from your philately sales to cross-subsidize your courier business, which competes with other local couriers. So they should have looked at it on a function basis and said these functions have to be ring-fenced and the law does apply to them. And, only certain statutory functions, where, like the housing authority, for example, they would have to be exempted because they offer deeply subsidised rentals to for social reasons. So you would exempt them, but you would do it on an exception basis.
But how much do normal average Hong Kong people care about post office and whether they're competing with other people?
Well, the SME cares about his courier costs, I think, and his choice in that
don't
sector.
Don't they care more about going to the supermarket and feeling or thinking, or there's a perception that there's price fixing?
Yes, and you know, the problem has been until now, and this is why one of the benefits of the law will be that we now have a statutory body that has investigative powers. It can demand information from people in the sectors, whereas in the past it could not. So you know, when the government, I forget which body did it, but there was a study of fuel supply in Hong Kong, and they basically shrugged their shoulders and said, well, no one's provided us with any evidence of anti-competitive behaviour because they don't have to. and so, you know, that situation went on. But it can't go on much longer. And I think it's quite notable that Lee Ka-shing, through Hutchison Whampoa, tried to sell Park & Shop about a year ago. I think the margins in that sector are about to come under some pressure because of
clear... You think you're going to go for Park & Shop?
Sorry?
You think they're going to go for Park & Shop?
No, I think that that some of the past practices will just have to end. They might end quietly. You might never know that they existed. If there is any price fixing between major supermarkets, or if there is any pressure on suppliers not to supply other smaller people who are trying to break into the market, that sort of anti-competitive practice will be hardcore and will have to end. And retail price maintenance, I think, will also have to end, where suppliers say to people, you can't take our products unless you sell them for at least X. There was a famous case of a small retailer who was discounting noodles, I think, pot noodles, and was basically supplies were withdrawn from him for that reason.
What about stuff like if you go into a building, and this has happened to me personally, where you go into a building and you've bought, for example, a broadband from one company, you want to move it into your new apartment, and they say, no, you can only buy the one we're selling.
That's also covered. That's
bundling.
Also covered. Bundling sale. I agree with everything what David says, but I think to start with, looking forward, I think to start with, it's probably easier for the Commission to, you know, go after abusers of dominant position rather than to go after people, you know, having agreements to limit competition, because it's generally easier to get, you know, to prosecute abusers of dominant position. You know, immediately, you know, it comes to mind industries like television industry. You know, TVB has been dominant, you know, for a very long time in the market. It has a lot of practices which are very, very suspect.
Some of which are under consideration.
That's right. It's already under consideration. You know, the supermarket chain, again, is another market which is heavily dominated by a few players. In fact, as much as over 90%. So these are the areas which I think affect the community most and probably relatively easier to go after.
And will they do that? Go ahead.
Can I just say that's partly true, but it's also the case that, first of all, cartel activity, any agreement on prices, is also very, very detrimental for consumers.
Of course, yeah.
In fact,
all I'm saying is it's not easy.
That shows that it's even more detrimental. But also, whether it's easier to pursue a case of dominance or agreements, it's also, again, a little bit debatable, because for dominance cases, you require very, very complex economic analysis. You need to prove dominance. You need to carry out a thorough study of the relevant market, defining the relevant market. And that requires a very high level of expertise, which, of course, the Commission has, but it will take a little bit of time. With cartels, it's so clear that they are anti-competitive that all that is normally required in other jurisdictions is to prove that the cartel actually exists. You don't need to enter into a full analysis of effects, etc. Just the mere existence of the cartel is so detrimental.
Is there a cartel existing in Hong Kong, in your opinion?
Well,
can you think of anything that hits you right away, that this is a cartel, this is anti-competitive?
Well, that's the problem, that so far we don't have any evidence, because we have not had the powers to investigate cartels.
What about, the gas speculation? Buying petrol, gas, if you want to go fill up your car, and all these filling stations, gas stations, aren't they seen as or perceived as a cartel?
Yeah, well, one can suspect that there is something going on there, but of course, because so far we didn't have the power to investigate such behavior, then we don't have any evidence. But hopefully now with the new competition ordinance, once it enters into force, these are the kinds of things that will be discovered.
Well, I don't disagree that the first conduct rule is very important, but like what Sandra has admitted, in Hong Kong it's not easy as in other jurisdictions to identify whether or not there are cartels in existence, whereas the dominant players in various markets are very dominant. In fact, I don't think you need to ask people whether TVB is dominating the television market, or certain supermarket chain is dominating the supermarket market. So, the Commission has just come out, I think rightly saying, that the 25% rule should not be, fixed. It should not be immovable. So what they're saying really is, I hope that in different markets you can go lower than 25%, and that is a good indication of how the Commission looks at player qualifies a dominant player.
You say TVB, but TVB can always argue. We have better programs. The only thing that argue is that they force their artists.
What you got to remember is that everything that all of these players have been doing is legal. And it will remain legal until this law comes into effect. And you can't blame them for doing what comes naturally.
Yeah, but then...
If, and I'm not saying they have, but if, for example, they've been saying to advertisers, we'll give you a discount if you only advertise with us and not with the other channel. Or if they've been saying to their, under their entertainment contracts, you can only work for us if you never work for the other TV company, or if you only speak Cantonese and not English, or vice versa on their channels. These kinds of practices are legal now, but will be illegal under the competition law.
Yeah, but supposing you work for the South China Morning Post, they say, you can't go work for the Hong Kong Standard. That's natural, isn't it? You can't work for the Washington Post and then work for the New York Times as well.
Restraints of trade is another area. It's labor law rather than competition law.
So long as it doesn't affect competition, then it's all right. I think that the key word you're looking for is that people do, whether it would affect competition or not affect competition. The fact that you've got good programs is... nowhere to the point.
Okay, of course, having good programs is not a violation of competition law. As long as if you offer a better product and you have a dominant position, just because you're
that's
completely legal. The problem is if you're doing anything anti-competitive, if you're harming your competitors or doing anything to harm consumers. So that would be the difference according to the law.
Yeah, but it does matter what your market share is. I mean, if you had an exclusive agreement, but you only had one starlet under your management, you're not going to be causing anti-competitive effects in the market. Whereas if you have 80% of the broadcast market and you say that you'll never work for us unless you promise not to work for anyone else, then you do have a dominant position which is being abused. So what is legal for a smaller player might not be legal for a dominant player. They have to behave better.
What about the exceptions or loopholes, Sandra Marcolina? Under the first conduct rule, the agreements are excluded from the rule if they satisfy the exclusion criteria in relation to enhancing overall economic efficiency. That sounds like a big loophole.
That is something common in other jurisdictions as well, because you have to think that businesses enter into agreements every day, and there's so many of these agreements that are perfectly lawful. But of course, if you enter into an agreement, you're somehow restricting, oftentimes you restrict competition. What happens is that sometimes these restrictions, when you actually look at them and you look at their effect, they actually bear more pro-competitive effects than anti-competitive effects. And therefore, there has to be room in the legislation to allow for some restrictions, provided that they have a wider pro-competitive goal. So that is why this exception is included. And this is very similar to the EU law legislation. And it actually works relatively well. I mean, it makes it, of course, a little bit more complex when it comes to developing the policy. But I think this will be, hopefully, what we are hoping to see is clarification on this in the guidelines, in the forthcoming guidelines.
Okay, here's a case study from, this is a news report from April this year, about gold sales. Gold retailers fear small companies will be forced out of business if the competition law bans the current system under which two trade associations, they set a daily price across the industry. The people running the small jewellery shops say they're worried that customers may get upset if they make a purchase and notice the shop next door is offering a lower gold price, so they sort of set a standard gold price across the members of the shops. Is that simply anti-competitive practice? Would that have to end under this? What would you say?
Well, no, because, I mean, you're talking about the reference price of gold. But as long as they're competing around that and saying, well, you know, we're only charging 2% markup today and your next-door shop is charging 5% markup, given that the vast majority of the value of these things is the gold in them.
No, they say a 10% profit margin is added onto that.
Well, if you're fixing margins, then you're definitely in anti-competitive territory. Mm. But there will be, if they're competing on the margins, then that's not the case. And, you know, there will be a gold price from various markets around the world that you could refer to.
Well, I think if you say that, if I can't earn more than 10% profit, then I have to go out of business, then please leave the business. Period. Period.
Yeah. I mean, it's not. Just remember that quite a few anti-competitive practices have gone away in the last 20 years or so. It wasn't that long ago that solicitors had what they called scale fees on conveyancing. So there was a fixed rate of charge for conveyancing, and conveyancing charges dropped probably 80% when that was abolished in the 1990s, I think around 98. And stockbrokers used to have a minimum commission of 0.25%. Their cartel was called the Stock Exchange of Hong Kong Limited. Yeah. They owned it. And that was set in a rule in the stock exchange, and that was abolished finally in 2003. So, we now have rates much lower than that, even for retail customers.
Okay. Well, when I said 10% profit margin, I don't think that's 10% profit necessarily, and that's just a 10% margin, which is added for, you know, to cover other costs, probably, you know, I assume.
Yeah, staff and rent, things like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, and so on. But in that case, for example...
But the point is, you can't agree as a cartel to have a fixed percentage gross profit margin. And in reality, you don't. But what's irritating is, with things like retail price maintenance, is seeing the same label everywhere. And then only when you agree to buy something do they say, oh, psst, there's a 10% discount today.
All right. What about the fact that, say, in that case, there is kind of strength in numbers, that the small little jewellery shops... will be undercut and will be swept away by the big jewellery shops.
Only if they're more efficient, and that's good for the consumer.
Yeah, but then you end up with less competition, or you end up with a
predatory price cutting is a form of abuse of dominant position, and as you see in the report that has just been issued the other day, that's one of the practices which the commission would target at.
So you mean to say a big company cannot force out a little company?
That's right.
by cutting prices
That's
so
right.
that the little guy can't survive.
That's right.
So the little guy goes away, and then the big guy comes back and then increase the prices.
Well, that's one of the typical anti-competitive behaviour.
Yes.
That's
famous case on
it?
This
that's,
was...
That's been happening since the dawn of time.
Well, famous examples are in the airline industry. If you remember Freddie Laker and his SkyTrain service in the 1970s, British Airways basically engaged in predatory pricing. They cut the fares on the only route that he was serving to try and drive him out. And if a budget airline starts up in Hong Kong and Cathay were to do the same thing to them, that would be predatory pricing.
Yeah.
So does this
loss leaders, are they is that predatory pricing if they're not particularly targeted, but if they're if you sell one product well below cost,
only if it has damaging effect.
That's right. It's a complex issue. I mean, you don't just look at the cutting of the prices. You've got to look behind it to see whether or not.
So things like what happened with the supermarket, that European supermarket, I forget the name, that tried to come into
Carrefour.
Yeah, those things are not going to happen again. Or Jimmy Lai trying to open up a website supermarket.
Jimmy Lai swears that was nothing.
He was forced out.
Well, no, he says he wasn't.
He said he wasn't.
No, no,
okay.
No. He said just his business
that's
model was wrong. No, no, I've heard him say that. I've always heard.
Well, in Carrefour's case, it was suppliers' problems.
Yeah.
So that can never happen again.
Hopefully.
Okay.
Well, that's what we hope.
All right. We're just going to break for 3 minutes for the news and continue. We're also going to be talking about increases in the ferry fares. The weather before the news. Now, it's going to be mainly fine, apart from some isolated showers this afternoon. Very hot. Maximum temperature 33 degrees. Very hot in the next few days, too. 28 degrees now. Relative humidity is at 82%. And the very hot weather warning is also in force. Back in 3 minutes' time. Welcome back. This is Backchat, a Wednesday morning with Michael Cigani and me, Hugh Chiverton, continuing to talk about the competition bill as the Competition Commission yesterday launched a 6-month consultation looking for views on how they're going to enforce the competition ordinance, which will take effect by middle of next year. Talking about setting up some guidelines, how tough are they going to be? Will they go to court? Should the priorities be? What about the remedies? We'd like to hear from you. You can email backchat@rthk.hk. You can call us 233-88266. You can text 63935925. Email backchat@rthk.hk. There's our Facebook page as well, Backchat on RTHK Radio 3. We're going to be talking later also about the ferry fare increase. Your thoughts on that are very welcome. A couple of comments from listeners. I guess, by the way, I should have said, in our central studio, David Webb, founder and editor of website.com, and join us on the line, Sandra Marco Calino, assistant professor in the Faculty of Law at the Chinese University. Okay, an email from Alfred, who signs himself Alfred, a small suffering potato. The small suffering potato says, good morning, Backchat. The SAR government's determination to the full implementation of the competition ordinance should be welcomed to the benefit of the community's reputation as an international business hub. But should we not underestimate the difficulty in enforcing the ordinance? How to impose penalty on overseas business? With the prevalence of online business and transactions, if the offenders are overseas companies, such as BVI companies, how can we impose penalty on these companies which are incorporated in other jurisdictions? Also, how can we veto further physical or online business activities from these companies? Second, how to identify a virtual monopoly? Further, is it possible that the offenders deliberately set up a lot of related companies which occupy only a small portion of market share each? The public will easily have an illusion that there is no existence of monopoly. How can we identify these virtual competitive markets which are of monopoly in nature, in reality? Asks Alfred. A couple of interesting questions there. Professor Marco Colino, what about the overseas companies, first of all? Would we have jurisdiction? I don't know. If they're operating online, not much we can do, is there?
Well, if they're active in Hong Kong and when you calculate the relevant market in Hong Kong, if they're operating in the Hong Kong market, yes, the law would apply. It could apply, yes.
It's unenforceable, though, isn't it?
it's difficult to enforce, but there are, I mean, this is actually commonly done. I mean, we have in the EU, every time that, for instance, an American company is operating in the EU, what matters is not where the company is based, but whether or not it is operating in the market and where the law applies. That's the important thing.
Yeah, I don't see a problem with that because you need a business registration if you're carrying on business here. Almost by definition, you are exposing yourself to sanctions because we can stop you carrying on business here or we can fine you. So I don't worry too much about BVI companies setting themselves up in Hong Kong rather than being Hong Kong companies. The place in which they're incorporated doesn't matter. And, of course, only 10% of companies listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange are incorporated in Hong Kong now as an indicator of the fact that domicile doesn't matter.
They have to comply with all the laws to operate in Hong Kong. They have to comply with competition laws, more law.
Yeah, and I don't worry about the fragmentation point. Sorry, I come back to that point. 10% of turnover is the maximum penalty for 3 years. 3 years of turnover at 10%. There isn't a criminal sanction here. There's no possibility of company directors being jailed for causing their companies to engage in price fixing or cartel behaviour.
They can be stopped from being a director, can't they?
That's all. But in America there is a criminal regime for this, and Alfred Taubman of Sotheby's famously was jailed over the price fixing of auction fees with Christie's.
What about this other? Let me just go back to. Did you say only 10% of Hong Kong companies are based in Hong Kong?
No. Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, the number of listed companies, only 10% are domiciled, incorporated in Hong Kong. The others are incorporated mainly in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, two other British colonies, as it were. They still are. And 10% are in PRC, roughly. There's a handful of others. Yeah. But that doesn't matter because they're all listed here. They're doing business here. They're subject to our company law because they are registered here.
Okay. So they can still be targeted?
Yes.
What about the second point raised by Alfred, a virtual monopoly where a dominant player would set up a lot of...
I think the law looks through the corporate veil. It's going to look at conglomerates, and Sandra will correct me if I'm wrong, but they have thought about that.
Right. Does that happen in other places?
Yes, you couldn't dodge around the law by setting up, five breaking yourself into five wholly owned subsidiaries. That would still be you. Mm. There are of course thousands of subsidiaries of the major conglomerates here. There's probably one for each building that they own, one for each hotel that they own, and so on. But if they start rigging hotel prices with their competitors, they won't be exempt just because each one of them is a small company.
All right. I think Housing Estate of Brett is having a bad day. He just says, with the subject line, typical Hong Kong, he says, we get another dog's breakfast, says Housing Estate Brett. Any indication of that?
As I said at the beginning, the law is, well, it's like Swiss cheese, really. It's full of holes, but... the lack of a merger regime applicable to anything except telecoms, despite the recognition of its benefits. That was a big compromise, and one that has to be corrected in a later revision of the law.
What happens in other places? This is based roughly on the Australian model. Is that right? The approach here.
Well, we do have a few Australians in the staff already. The senior executive director is no relation of mine, Rose Webb.
We did invite them on this morning, but they weren't able to provide any.
Yeah, that's a bit strange. I mean, 2 days ago they had this flurry of promotion, and then they won't put people up to explain the law to people.
That's very typical.
When a new body gets going like this with a new law, they do have a big outreach mission. They're trying to do a bit of that with this.
I thought this is just the sort of consultation that they would be interested in.
No, they'd rather they announce it. Okay, it's done. You guys wanted it, and then everybody forgets about
it. they're Australians, so.
The economic principles at stake are similar all over the world. I mean, we don't have a different arithmetic in Hong Kong, so the principles are pretty common around the world. But the degree of sanctions varies. As I said, there's criminality in America, criminal sanctions that there isn't here. I can't recall, Sandra, whether that's applicable in the EU. Can you jail directors or only
in some member states, according to some national competition law.
What about that exemption, the other thing that gets David Webb's goat, the exemption for government? Do you find that in many other jurisdictions?
It's not very common. No, I mean, that's normally it's not according to the body, but according to whether normally the rule is that any entity that engages in an economic activity would be subject to the law, and anybody that is in a specific case operating as an undertaking and it's engaging in economic activity would be caught. That's the criterion to distinguish between those bodies that would be caught by the law and those that would be not within the jurisdiction.
Yeah, but you would do it on an exception basis. For example, you would exempt the National Health Service from underpricing its services because it does. It's paid for by the taxpayer. So it competes with private hospitals, but should not be subject to the law itself, not as far as the service side goes.
Yeah.
David Webb, if you were in charge of this new commission, would you sit there and wait for, like Ronnie Tong said, whistleblowers to turn up, or would you be proactive and start targeting some
anti-competitive
behavior? And what would you target first? What springs to mind?
First of all, I'd make sure I had a budget to do it, and that's an issue, as Anna Wu mentioned the other day. If you don't have the resources to employ enough people or to pay investigative teams to go in and search for records, and this could involve trawling through millions of emails, for example, to find smoking guns on price-fixing, then you've got a problem. So first of all,
Do they have this?
But they do,
backup staff.
I don't know what the budget's going to be yet. I don't think anyone does.
Do they have a right to go into an office? I want to look at your documents.
If they have reasonable suspicion, yeah. I forget the exact wording in the law, but there will be investigative powers, and they should be actively pursuing.
So it's almost like an ICAC.
I mean, I'm sure they'll get plenty of complaints once they're open for business. Whereby they can then look at those complaints and decide whether to investigate. There probably will be questions about supermarkets, questions about fuel pricing, questions about maybe things like cement supplies if you're in the construction sector. And, that will give them a reason to look, but they can spontaneously look as well. They can commence their own investigations.
They can do that,
and they
right?
should. The whistleblowing thing is quite interesting, though, is that in many jurisdictions this has been proven useful. The first member of a cartel to blow the whistle is exempt from fines. So that gives them, it's a bit of game theory going on here, because it gives them an incentive if they think that the cartel is going to be revealed anyway, then it's the first one in to provide the evidence will be exempt. The others
won't. But are these whistleblowers, are their identities protected, or do they have to come and testify openly in court?
Well, they'd be obvious because they'd be the only one who weren't prosecuted.
Who isn't fined, yes.
Yeah.
No, but it's all official
because they're always the ones that they get a fine imposed, but then the fine is condoned. It's not actually applied.
Yeah.
You have to think that cartel activities normally takes place, it's all secret. So it's very, very hard to crack a cartel because all the cartel participants are benefiting.
I think Michael's asking, could individuals be protected if they blow the whistle on their employer?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I asked that is in Hong
Yes,
Kong, you can have six guys with choppers chopping you up if you're identified.
Well, that's a, there are
confidentiality. That's the reason I asked, that are they protected?
I think there's confidentiality obligations on the commission.
On the individual, yes.
On the commission. So they must treat complaints confidentially. They can't reveal the name of the complainant to the person about which they're complaining.
Ms. Marco-Colino, what's been the experience then around the world? What are the hot issues? Where do people find, because these, you know, we're just kind of catching up with other people. Where do you find are the points of friction? Where does the competition ordinances in other places run into trouble?
I mean, I think one of the most debated areas is going to be the treatment for vertical agreements. So things like what you were saying, these agreements that may have pro and anti-competitive effects, where do you draw the line for the legality? That will be a hot topic, and hopefully the guidelines will shed some light on,
can you give
on
us an example
what the policy is going to be.
What you mean by that? Can you give us an example?
For instance, distribution contracts. And we were talking earlier about resale price maintenance. So when a manufacturer tells the dealers a minimum price to charge for the goods, that's almost like price fixing between the dealers, but it's not actually an agreement between them. It comes imposed by the manufacturer. Can we say that is legal, or is that also
illegal? Well, in most places it's illegal, isn't it? Because it damages competition.
Although now in the US there's this ambiguous position towards it, so it will be interesting to see what will happen in Hong Kong.
One of the other things is that this law sets a tone. It sets an economic principle into our law for the first time, that competition is good, and then that leads us to question other statutory arrangements or administrative arrangements. For example, the fact that in order to drive a taxi for a living, you have to pay somebody else not to, because there's a fixed quantity of licenses, and the value of those has been escalating. For example, the fact that there's only one legal bookmaker in Hong Kong, and it's illegal to place a bet even with an overseas legal bookmaker, because the law says you can't. The Jockey Club is the legalized monopoly, and that ought to end. We ought to have a licensing regime for bookmakers.
The issue there would be on public policy concerns.
Similarly, well, no, we've accepted that gambling is okay. Otherwise, we would have banned the Jockey Club as well.
I agree.
The stock exchange is a legally protected monopoly, rather than allowing competing exchanges to drive down transaction costs and improve service. We wouldn't be debating whether to stay open at lunchtime or not if we had competition.
But there you go. Absolutely. Sometimes, isn't it better in the general interest if there is only one Jockey Club? One stock exchange. You don't think so? You don't agree with that at all?
Not in the case of the Jockey Club and the stock exchange.
Do you think that we gain from that monopoly?
That's what they would say, but the answer is no. You have artificially high profit margins at the Jockey Club because there isn't competition. There's no betting exchanges in Hong Kong, for example.
But a lot of the money goes back into charity.
Most of it goes directly to the government in taxation, and they could tax bookmakers anyway. This charity thing is a fig leaf to protect the monopoly of the Jockey Club, and less than 1% of their betting turnover goes into the charity trust, which eventually spends some of it on charities and hoards a lot of it itself. There's about 15% for the 1% that goes into the charities trust. There's 15% that goes to the government.
It doesn't make. Yeah, okay.
Even assuming that there were charity issues, I mean, opening the market up, it wouldn't really make a difference with that. I mean,
no, the government would still build hospitals and schools, even if the Jockey Club wasn't allowed to do it or didn't do it anymore because it couldn't afford to. So it's an off balance sheet arm of the government. It's the government's betting monopoly. And with stock exchanges, there are ways to solve the fragmentation issue and to have competition between competing trading venues. There are many of them in Europe under something called MiFID, and there are many competing exchanges in the US. But what's happening in Hong Kong is that the SFC is currently proposing to prohibit potential new entrants, so-called dark pools, from offering services to retail investors.
All right. I know what David Webb thinks, but I don't know what Sandro Marcolino is going to say. Do you think Hong Kong is a competitively minded place? It's kind of ironic, you know, we talk about the competitiveness of Hong Kong, but a lot of people feel that, you know, internally we're not very competitive, that you do tend to get monopolies of many things. How do you think generally we compare in Hong Kong with other economies?
Well, I think that's the main issue, that I think that there's this idea of course, Hong Kong, the open market economy, it's very important and it works very well. But when you actually look at specific markets, there are many apparent problems that exist that make it...
Apparent or real?
Well, we can't say they're real until there's ongoing investigations, but I mean, they look fairly real, and certainly that's what we expect, that there will be investigations once the commission starts its operation.
All right, the housing state. Brett says, I said he was in a bad mood. He says, on the contrary, Sir H, I just stated the obvious, and David Webb agrees with me. Other than being bit by Mozzies last night, 16 floors up, my day has been fantastic and just keeps getting better, says housing estate Brett. Thank you very much indeed for that. And thank you to our guests this morning, to Sandro Marcolino, Assistant Professor in the Faculty of Law at the Chinese University, and David Webb, founder and editor of website.com, and also speaking editor Ronnie Tong from the Civic Party. Thank you all very much indeed. 20 past.